Well, good evening and welcome to the Digital Finance Analytics live stream event for the 18th of August 2020. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Great to have you on the show tonight. Thanks very much for taking some of your time out of your evening. We've got a lot to get through this evening and pleased to say we've got a good number already on. New names, some old names as well. Old in terms of length of time, in terms of visiting DFA, nothing about age. Just to be clear, so there's a lot to share tonight. So without further ado, we might begin to move the conversation forward. And I'm just going to start with my normal introductions in terms of what we're going to do today. So we'll just do this introduction, the house rules, our models, some key slides, questions and answers, and then we'll sign off. This will probably run for about an hour and a half, give or take. Plenty of questions, I think, will come out. I've got some questions from beforehand if we need to get to them as well. And just in terms of house rules, as always, I have to say this isn't financial advice. I'm not qualified to give it. I don't know your individual circumstances. It's my general opinion and analysis and all the things that I do, but it's not tailored to anybody specifically. So don't take it as financial advice. Go see a financial advisor if you need specific advice. Please do play nice in the chat room. No racial slurs. Stream is being moderated. Plexus does a great job. Thanks, Plexus. And this is at the 18th of August 2020. I guess if you're watching this a few years later, you'll know whether I was right, whether I was wrong. We'll see. Please use App Walk the World if you want to get my attention. There's always plenty of stuff going on the chat, and I encourage it in terms of some of the cross-current conversations. That's perfectly fine. But if you want to get my attention, use App Walk the World. I have enabled Super Chat, which does two things. Firstly, if you want to make sure that your question goes to the top of the list, you can use Super Chat. And it's also a way of just making a donation to support DFA. DFA is a not-for-profit in a way. We're not designed to make money off what we do, but we do have costs that need to be covered, and that helps to cover some of the costs and allows me to build more content and spend more time sharing my thoughts with a greater audience. So that's what this is all about. Now, just in terms of my model, as always, for those who are new, this is not just opinion. This is based on good research, based on our 52,000 household surveys. We run those continuously, 1,000 new a week, and we pull in information from theirs, from other sources too, into our core market model. And the core market model is essentially our main analytic engine, and that then feeds all our various industry reports. It feeds our blog, it feeds the YouTube channel, and also client engagements as well. And the point to make about this is all based on first-level research. And that's quite important to understand because we get information in on a Tuesday each week for the previous week. So it's always very up to date. And we can slice and dice the data all sorts of ways, as I've explained many times before. It's a Rubik's Cube. You know, you can manipulate it and pull the information out a few different ways. And we quite often do that. And our core market model essentially allows us then to move forward and think about some of the scenarios too. And the scenarios essentially are a way of trying to explain how we see the market moving ahead 3 years out, up to 3 years out. And those scenarios do change from time to time. And in addition to that, the core market model powers our price scenario. So we put the mortgage stress, the price trajectory, the buying and selling intentions, the migration, all the economic data into the core market model and into the scenarios. And then that drives the home price model. And this is now something you'll see quite often from me. It's a way of trying to just demonstrate what the trajectory of home prices is. And we can go actually quite granular. So just to give you sort of an initial example, this is for New South Wales, right? So for this particular one, the top line is where prices may go over 3 years, one, two, three, if things go well. So in other words, 6 to 7% down over the next 12 months, slightly further down the next 12 months and almost nothing after that. Or if things go really badly, then we go down 15% or more in the first 12 months and more than 30% over 3 years. And my midpoint, which is essentially what I think the base case actually looks like, is down 21.5% over 3 years. That's my current view for New South Wales. And just to sort of whet your appetite, I can do the same thing for other places. This is their ACT, for example. So you can see there how that the ACT is down 18.5% as a midpoint. Northern Territory is down 17.6%. The Queensland is down 17.9%. South Australia is down 17.1% at the moment. And you'll see that in South Australia, the best scenario actually takes it into slightly positive territory for a few months before it goes negative after that. Tasmania, which is even more positive in my most aggressive scenario. So I'm predicting slight rises in Tasmania for the next 12 months before it falls away, down 17.1%. And then we can go to Victoria, which is looking quite a lot sicker, down 23.5%, and down 10% as a best case now in Victoria, and falling the second year as well. And we can even look at WA, which then gives us 18.9%. So, you know, not too bad if things go really well, but not so good if things go less well, of course. And Australia-wide is 20.4% is my mid-case over 36 months now. And that varies, of course, between the like low case and the high case. But the point I wanted to make was I now have the ability to go into every postcode and produce a similar trajectory. So here's a couple of ACT examples, and you can see how they move around. And we can actually go to any postcode in the country. So here's one, let's say Bondi Beach in New South Wales, down 26.2. That's a pretty significant fall there in my midpoint. Or if you go to, let's go somewhere else. Let's go to Canal, which I saw was down quite dramatically today. Down 23.3% is my prediction over 3 years. We can go into other states too. Here's a Queensland one. Let's go to that one there. Don't quite know which part of Queensland that's in, at 4744, but there's a 15% mid-place fall. And if we go to another state, let's go to South Australia. How about Happy Valley in South Australia? Again, possibility in a good scenario of price rises for the next few months, but my mid-case is a little less positive and therefore negative, down 16.2%. And we can go into other states too. Tasmania, Old Beach. Again, interesting, a little bit of a positivity there if the scenarios are, you know, the best ones. But if my line is right, then slightly down and then down 20%. And then finally to just go to WA. There we are. Cable Beach, WA. Down 17.7. I just want to show this to illustrate two things. One is we actually do think about the whole country, not just New South Wales and Victoria. And secondly, there's plenty of information available. And I use this now in conjunction with my other research when I'm actually talking to individual households. And I'll come back to that a bit later when I discuss some more. So let me just go back to the slideshow, which is that one there. Now, just in terms of other things before I get into the detail, RBA minutes. The minutes today didn't tell us anything new because we'd already got a lot of information out from earlier on. But essentially, they're saying the economy is going through a difficult period. Government support programs will be required. The recovery is likely to be slower than earlier expected with COVID-19 outbreaks in Victoria. So, and they talked about their three scenarios, which I've covered on earlier posts. So I'm not going to cover them again. They've underscored the fact that the ADIs are continuing to draw on the liquidity facility. So what's happening is a lot of ADIs are pulling funds out at low rates from the Reserve Bank to lend at cheap rates into the market. And that's what the bank wanted to do. It's forcing rates down, of course, as is the bond purchases to keep the three-year bond rate within band. And also, the bank's going to purchase Australian government bonds in the secondary market from the 5th of August 2020 as necessary to keep the rates in the bath they want. Now, yesterday I discussed at some length the consequences and implications of what the RBA was talking about, so I'm not going to go over that again, but they just underscored that. And they basically said they're happy with the measures that are there, but they can review them, and you know, so no chance of rates going higher in any short term. That's that. Now, Westpac, we should go and have a quick look at Westpac, because Westpac actually announced today that they were not going to pay a dividend. And that, of course, is partly in response to what APRA was asking the banks to consider. CBA, of course, paid a reduced dividend in their results recently. But essentially, they've said that whilst the earnings was actually up quite a lot, the margins were compressed, asset deterioration is well underway, and the 90-day delinquencies were up 55 basis points, and we'll come onto that in a second in more detail. Deferral packages, there are still quite a few people with mortgage payments being deferred, and whilst their balance sheet is relatively strong at 10.8 in CET1 ratio terms, they decided that it would be appropriate to withdraw dividends. Now, that's very different from other banks, right? So particularly CBA. So I'm fascinated by how CBA and Westpac are managing this crisis very differently, because basically CBA is saying, oh, it's nothing much to see, it's going to all go right. I think Westpac's closer to the wind in terms of understanding what's going on. And they made the point, and this is a really critical chart, that the Australian mortgage 90-day delinquencies, 90-day this is, not 30-day, 90 days, so these are mortgages that are definitely out of state, have literally gone through the roof. So look here, this is the Western Australian one from where we were to where we are now, but all the other states are also rising. And this looks to be much higher than their peers, although partly some of the issues that they've got with the mortgage support is because they're further through the process. So that what they've said is there's about 78,000 mortgage holders who are actually out of, if you like, normal process with their mortgages. And that's dropped from 135,000. That's worth about $30 billion. And you can see there that 63% of them are unoccupied, 78% are principal interest loans, and 20% have more than 3 months repayments ahead. Weird that. How can you be ahead and yet out of, I don't know how that works. And the weighted LVR is 66%. But the point is, they're 85% through the way now of these checks. So they're phoning people up and saying, are you actually okay with your mortgages or not? Are you going to be able to get your income back or not? They've also moved their offshore collection support from offshore to onshore, so their collections are now here. And there are some accounting differences between other banks, which I won't go into at the moment. And they made the point, of course, that mortgage possessions were only quite small. So in other words, loans that are actually gone bad and the bank's taken possession of the properties is quite low. But the point here is that this conversation with borrowers is very much going to be about whether they are able in the next few months to be able to get normalised on their accounts or not. And if they're not, then essentially the bank's going to have to say, well, maybe we should think about helping you to sell the property. And Ross McEwan last Friday at NAB said, you know, if there are people in financial difficulty, now's a good time to think about selling. I think that's quite an important message. He, of course, Ross, came from the UK and so from the Royal Bank of Scotland, and was through the 2007-8-9 crisis. So he's aware of what happens in a crisis. Okay, now some other interesting data. So ANZ released some high-frequency data today saying that although the containment of COVID-19 outside of Victoria has been largely successful, overall high-frequency data shows the recovery around Australia is regressing after slowing in late June. In other words, things are going off the boil, not just in Victoria, but in other states too. That's consistent with my data, as I'll show in a second. Now, Roy Morgan did say, whoa, whoopee, things are a little firmer. And this is the headlines that made the news tonight about household confidence is, you know, stronger than it was previously. Well, yeah, but just look, it's stronger on a very low base, right? Gained 2.4% over the last week, coming after seven straight weeks of decline. And in fact, all the sub-indices gained pretty much current finances, current economic conditions, time to buy a household item gained. Inflation expectations were stable. The point, though, of course, is this is just very, very, very marginal movement. And the sub-indices gained with the exception of current finances. Current finances went against the overall trend with a fall of 1.9%. In other words, people's current financial situation has deteriorated even from last week, according to this survey. And that's pretty much consistent with what I'm seeing. So look, the news, of course, was full of the peak, the rise, you know, everything's perfect. No, it's not perfect at all. It's just slightly less negative than previously. Now, SQM released their data on auctions. And just to reiterate that there's lots of rhubarb being written about auction clearance rates and how everything's back to normal. I think the SQM approach to auction clearances is the most accurate. So you can see there that Sydney's at 48%. Melbourne's at 47% on a very low volume. And, you know, Brisbane, Perth, very low. Of course, very small numbers. Hobart, 100% auction clearance rate because they had one auction. So it just shows you that you've got to be careful with these numbers. You can easily get effectively sort of steered off in the wrong direction. So don't be misled by what the newspapers are saying about high auction clearance rates and how everything's wonderful. It's not true. And just another not true. So the CoreLogic mortgage index that's come out again shows that the volume of mortgages being written is down across the board, other than in WA. WA was very slightly up, 0.5%, but everybody else was down. And the forward index is also down. So I don't think we're going to see much of a bounce in lending and mortgage origination over the next few months. And that means there's probably going to be more negativity to home prices, as we'll discuss later. And just one other example, this is one from Cookie Boy that he sent out today, 143 Park Avenue in Ashfield, New South Wales, 2131, advertised at 1.23. That's the advertised price. Typical, of course, the settlement price will be lower than the advertised price. Last changed hands in November 2017 at 1.17. So not really a huge capital appreciation between 2017 and now. And interestingly, if you look at my stress data for this postcode, you can see there that we've got a lot of property investors who are actually stressed. We've got a lot of rental payers who are stressed, 72%. And we have quite a lot of mortgage stress there. And overall, 79.8% of households in the postcode are in some difficulty. So maybe it's not surprising and maybe we're going to see more on the market. So that's also an introduction to my stress and data, which we have, of course, available for every postcode in Australia. And also just from the conversation, there was a very good article that I do recommend you go look it out. They were looking at long trend housing and construction prices across Australia from 1875 to 2020, pretty much. And they highlighted the fact that until quite recently, there was pretty much a sort of a correlation between construction costs and house prices. But then it took off in the 60s. And in contrast, real Australian prices have soared 215% since 1980. And they then go on to talk about some of the reasons why that is, to do with lower lending standards, to do with the fact that you know, everyone was being encouraged to invest in property, all of those things that you've obviously fully aware of. They also made the point that for many Australians over this period, they actually made more in terms of value out of their property than they did out of working, which is a remarkable fact. In other words, you generated more out of just passively investing in your property over that time, rather than actually actively working, which is another reason why I think this is an unsustainable scenario. And they basically made the point, and this is one down here at the bottom, as rates of homeownership fall, renters struggle to make ends meet and central banks run out of leverage to stimulate the economy with interest rates already at rock bottom. Reforms that previously appeared politically impossible might gain traction. And I think that's the point. We've got to the point now where we've got to actually deal with this Ponzi scheme once and for all. This is an unsustainable position that we're in. Properties are relatively way too expensive relative to income, relative to GDP, relative to everything else. And this is not how it has to be. This is unusual because of all of the interventions that we've had, the central bank's intervention, the government, negative gear, things, a bunch of things like that. So we are in a very uncomfortable situation because of poor policy settings since the 1980s. Okay, and now quick recap on mortgage stress. It was up 40.2%. We discussed that 2 weeks ago. And, you know, all of the lockdowns are back. JobKeeper is sort of helping, but not dramatically so in some areas. Some people are returning to work. Some people are refinancing, but 40% of households in difficulty from a cash flow perspective. And now talk about household financial confidence, because that's, of course, the new data. So this is now the data up till the most recent survey round. 74.19 is the index now. So we dropped back. So we went down to 73.2, and then it came up a little, and now it's down again. So this is the overall summary of all of the elements of my household financial confidence index on a national average. And then you can look at it in terms of my segment. So this is actually looking at it from the free affluence, those renting, those mortgaged. Those renting and those mortgaged deteriorated further in the month, whereas those who have no mortgage and had shares, for example, were much more bullish to start with. I mean, they're still under 100, so it's not great, but they're not quite so bad as the others. And it's improved slightly. That's because stock markets have gone up. So that's one of the reasons why things are looking a little better for them. But remember, there's basically one third of the households renting, one third with mortgages, and one third who are mortgage free. So it's a third, a third, a third. So two thirds of the population saw a deterioration in the last month. Now, Victoria is leading the way down, of course, after the lockdown. The smaller states are doing a little better, but it's also worth highlighting the fact that New South Wales continues to decline as well. And in fact, New South Wales and Victoria are leading the way down now. That's not surprising. The question, of course, will be whether Victoria manages to come out of lockdown, or whether, in fact, Victoria stays in lockdown, and whether New South Wales goes into lockdown ahead. So who knows about that? Property investors continue to be negative. The owner-occupied borrowers are also getting more twitchy as well. You can see that here in terms of the numbers. In fact, pretty much everybody, even those renting, property owner-occupied active, property active owner-occupiers are there. The property active investors are here. And the property inactive, which include renters, are somewhere in the middle. That's widespread. In terms of the age groups, essentially, if you're younger or older, you're probably going to be less positive. If you are in your 50s or 40s to 50s, 50 to 60s, you've got a chance of being more positive. And that's partly because a lot of people in this group have less mortgages or no mortgages and have other assets like stock market assets. So they're seeing some positive moves, but others less so. And job security still remains a critical issue. This is actually the first part. It's come down just a little, but the less secure measure is still between 60 and 70, and that's very high. You see the jump up there from before COVID, right? That's a significant factor. Then you've got income pressures. Income pressures are still extreme. Very little increases in terms of real income for many people. Close to 70% have had no increase over the last little while. In fact, many people for many years. There's a small amount stayed the same and a very small number who've had real income growth. Cost of living continues to rise, and the data shows that the cost of living includes things like vegetables, for example, at the shops. Sort of day-to-day expenditure is biting. So almost everybody's saying it's more costly than it was last year. Debt remains a significant problem. And we continue to see the problem with people being less comfortable. More than 60% are less comfortable with their debt than they were this time last year. And that's a combination of, less income and all those things. They've still got the debt. And despite low interest rates, so low interest rates have not really taken the pain away. Not even refinancing has taken the pain away. And savings are also under pressure, although some are saving more. And interestingly, quite a few people who've got the government checks and got the superannuation rebates are actually saving them. Interesting is when you drill down why. They're saying because they're not clear about whether they'll have a job ahead. So they're trying to build a buttress for joblessness or less hours later. But many other people are having to raid their savings just to be able to continue to maintain their lifestyle. So that's not necessarily a very sustainable thing. So although the overall savings ratios will probably go up, if you break it down into different groups, you'll see that there are some groups with very little savings. We've got one third of households with less than 1 month's savings to be able to see them through. And so overall net worth actually continues to be supported by stock prices and by the fact that home price moves have been quite limited so far. Watch this space in terms of prices ahead. But net worth is lower for, over 60%, but there are some a little more bullish than previously. Now, in terms of scenarios, I've not updated the scenarios at all. This is from the last time, so I'm not going to go over this again, but just to make the point that my central scenario is still in the sort of the 15 to 30% range, and I've shown you some of that earlier on. I'll update this again at the end of this month, and we'll show it in a couple of weeks' time. All right, so there you go. That's a bit of an introduction, a bit of data. Now let me go over the conversations, and let's have a look and see what we're going to talk about. And I should explain, I'm not going to use my flashy little tool tonight, because the fact of the matter is that I've got so many questions coming up that, in fact, the tool is difficult. I've got to find an alternative way of doing it. So I'm just going to read them off the screen tonight. A few conversations there about too much discussion about gold for me. So I'm going to move on down there. So Yogi Bear asked, how much money does the government need to inject to counteract the falls? Now, there's some interesting modelling that's been done, and basically there's two scenarios. The scenario where the government says, we'll let property prices fall somewhat, but what we will do is support the banks through that cycle, right? And that would probably need 150, 200 billion, something like that. Or the other is to try and put enough liquidity into the market to be able to buy properties when they need to buy properties, to stop them falling, to be able to actually keep the whole market up. And that's probably 300 to 500 billion that will be required. So bearing in mind that the total debt in Australia is looking at around 850 billion, that's the total, we're talking, you know, not quite doubling, but a significant proportion over what we've got. And the question is, if you did that, what would the effect be, right? Because basically what I've said earlier on is that we've got huge amounts of issues with so many of the metrics being out of alignment. So if you support the market further and allow it to sort of muddle on, then the fall, the debt bomb, as it were, gets even bigger, and then you've got to deal with it. So the question becomes, what's the most elegant way to deal with a need to adjust the markets down? And that's why I'm more of the view that the banks are likely to be supported by the government via the RBA and directly if they get into difficulty, but it's unlikely that they will try and save the whole of the market. On the other hand, they will probably do things with the home builder and other elements too to try and support it for a period of time and try and muddle through, but we'll see. And of course, there's an election ahead, right? So in a way, my other point would be some people will say, well, try and support it up the election and then let it fall when Labour gets in and, you know, it's their problem. Or others would suggest that they want to try and demonstrate their ability to sort of turn the ship around before the election. I think the former is more likely to be true than the latter, personally. Now, there's a question from Dita saying, how is Tasmania positive if they've locked their borders until December? Well, it's about supply, demand, and, you know, what's going to happen. So in my central scenario, my assumption is that the support from central government will continue for somewhat longer than currently is there, and that will allow more households and more businesses to continue to tick over in this sort of limbo fashion. And that limbo fashion will support home prices in Tasmania for a period. But as the support is removed, as it will be eventually, and by the way, I think the government will have to extend it more than they're currently saying they will, then things will start to tumble away, because you're right, the borders are locked, tourism isn't happening, a lot of Tasmania's economy is powered by tourism, so that's why I still believe that there will be falls in Tasmania. But it could be, if that scenario is true, it could be delayed a little bit relative to some other states. And remember, of course, there was a significant run-up just before in Tassie. A lot of people buying property in Tasmania because they were cheap and they could see it rising. A lot of property investors, by the way, doing that too. That's beginning to change now. And in fact, some of the research I'm doing at the moment for a couple of my individual conversations suggests that some parts of Tasmania are already beginning to turn. So we'll see. Now, let's have a look here. What's this one? Murray Bridge 5253. That's from Bronson. Well, okay. Let's put up my postcode data. 8,000, 39% in financial stress, 2,700 borrowing, 4,400 renting, 3,300 properties for rent, 1,300 rental property owners, mild stress 1,222 at 45%, 2.4% defaults, 1,719 in rental stress, 39% in total there, and 31.3% of investors in stress. And just going back to my postcode prices, so the base case down 5.6% over 12 months, down 12.5% over 24 months, and down 19.2 over 36. So that's cumulative, obviously, rather than actually individual movements in the year. So there you go. That's that particular postcode. And apologies for not switching up when I did. There you go. Okay. Some conversations about the Gold Coast. Really, yeah, there are some areas in the Gold Coast where things are still going well, but there are also other areas where mortgage stress is rising quite firmly. Some of the units there don't look very flash, and some of my analysis from the mortgage stress stuff is also looking pretty negative. So I'm not convinced about the Gold Coast. Okay, now there's a question there. Can I distinguish between Melbourne and regional Victoria, please? And the short answer is not in this model at the moment. I will be able to do that later because I do have the ability to be able to actually stack the data different ways. What I can say, though, is that there are more significant falls in around metropolitan Melbourne than in the regional centres. The falls in the regional centres, however, are being impacted by COVID and the lockdowns. And so we are seeing, some significant moves in those regional areas. Overall, Victoria is looking the most wobbly state in terms of mortgage stress at the moment because of the lockdowns. Okay, 2525. This is from John Adams. I wonder if it's the John Adams. It could be, you know, could be. Let me put that one in. Edit the filter. Clear the list. 2525. Okay. 2525. Okay. I'm going to remember. Fig tree. Yes, it could well be. Could well be, Mr. Adams. He wants to know what his property is worth. Okay. So this is Fig Tree. 4,353 households. Down 43.8% of households in financial stress, 1,978 borrowing, 1,135 renting, 843 properties for rent, and the number of rental property owners, 1,368. There are 659 people in mortgage stress. That's 33%, so that's below the national average, although that's still quite high. Almost no rental... no defaults, 1.7, that's pretty good. But look at this, rental stress. A lot of people are finding it very difficult to pay the rent in this particular postcode, and that may well be part of the reason why investors are actually looking 25% stress, which is, by the way, 25% is roughly the amount of investor stress that we've seen nationally. Now, if I go to the prices, this is my base case at the moment, so 12% over the next 12 months, 18% over 24 months, and 36 months, 22. So basically you can see that the significant fall next year, small falls the following 2 years, and that's my base case, right? So, you know, if things move differently, then that's not going to be necessarily what we'll see, but that's the way that it looks at the moment. So I hope that's of some use, Sir John. I don't know whether that's what you thought was going to be happening, but let's go back there. There you go. Okay. Let me go back to that one. What else have we got? When should I sell my loft apartment in Melbourne 3000, says Kathleen. Well, I guess the first question is that an investment property or an unoccupied property? The reason I ask is that the highest stress postcode in the country for rental stress is actually 3,000. I might just put the figures up just so you can see them there. Let's put that in now. Clear list, 3,000. Yeah, so Melbourne is very, very interesting. And that's because, of course, there's a lot of people living close in. 22,000 households there, 75% in financial stress, 3,000 are borrowing, 18,000 are renting, and there are 14,000 properties for rent. And there are around 7,000 rental property owners living in the centre of Melbourne. Now, there's very little mortgage stress, which is interesting. There's very little default, but the rental stress is 69.9%. And that's one of the highest in the country. And in fact, the number, 12,900, is pretty much top of the list, as I discussed 2 weeks ago. And because of that, and because investor stress is very high, my belief is that we're going to see significant falls in 3,000. And in fact, this is my base case, 18% over the next 12 months, down 23% over 24 months, and down 36% over 36 months. So essentially, my view is that prices are on the way down. They were on the way down before COVID, but COVID has really created the catalyst. Lack of migration, lots of Airbnbs, lots of spare property in the centre of town, very high vacancy rates at the moment, and also rentals are dropping quite dramatically too. So all that together. So you've either got to, I think personally, make a decision about whether you want to move relatively quickly before prices go further, or whether you want to ride it through, because obviously there will be the other side. So at some point, we will see the borders reopen, we will see migration coming back, we will see students coming back. And at that point, some of those negative indicators for 3,000 and other places too might well turn around. The question is, how long will that be? And can you afford to ride it down? And how do you feel about the fact that you might end up with negative equity, or indeed just losing equity depending on when you bought, right? So that's the tricky situation. So, I mean, Russ McEwen did say that, you know, there will be some people who will be served better by selling sooner. And as Tony LeCantre would say, if you're going to panic, panic first. I think I've done the same again. Did I put it up? Hang on. Let me just show you the that slide. I'm not sure whether I put it up. I was too busy thinking about my answer. So the key point there is 69% of people in rental stress and 78% in investor stress. Not necessarily very, very good news, I'm afraid. Okay. There's a comment from Neil about gold leasing and how that makes a bullish case for crypto. Yeah, John Adams is going to come on to the Interest of the People channel in the next few days with the next part of his exploration of gold leasing. I can tell you it'll be quite a shocking one. And we're going to have to be careful to skate around a few things so we don't get ourselves into legal difficulty. There's a really big story to be told there. All I would say is that the manipulation that we're referring to here in terms of the metals markets is not completely gone when you come to the crypto markets either. So I think all of these financial markets have a degree of speculation and a degree of positioning and a degree of all those things. So, but I have to say that the more I look at the metals, the more concerned I become about all of the things that are going on below the waterline, and whether it's criminal or whether it's just traders having their day, we'll see. Okay. Nelson Bay, 2315. This is from Rod. Let me put up that. That's quite interesting. 2315, clear list. 2315. I was doing some research earlier on for somebody else on Nelson Bay. Okay, let me put the main camera on so you can see it. Okay, so there are 9,000 households in Nelson Bay, 58% of financial stress, 1,800 borrowing, 5,400 renting, 4,000 properties for rental, 2,400 property owners, investment property owners, that is. Mild stress, 1,558. That equates to 85.7%. So the point there is there's a lot of people in mortgage stress. So they've got financial flow issues with regard to their mortgages. We've got a default rate of 2.9%, which is beginning to get into quite high territory. And we've also got rental stress at 57%. And we've got investor stress at 40%. So overall, looks to me as though there are a few early warning signs there. And my scenarios are down 14.4% base over 12 months, down 20.3% over 24 months, and at 36 months, base is down 25. So that's more aggressive falls than some other places I've seen for the reasons that I've described. And it's partly because, of course, those areas are somewhat reliant on tourism and those sorts of things, and also the overall economic momentum, which could be a little lower. So, yeah, I'd be a little bit cautious about that particular postcode. Okay. Now, Cookie says, Bendigo Bank and Westpac, my number 1-2 to pop. yeah. Well, they both had issues. So I covered Bendigo yesterday, and of course, they've got this particular portfolio of mortgages that they did years ago. And they've been downvaluing them now. They downvalued them by 4% next year. And they're looking, hopefully, for a rebound 2 years later. So they definitely have issues. They also have issues with regards to trying to compete with the big guys when they don't really have a scale business. Westpac, as we discussed early on, very significant, different results from the likes of CBA, who really, I think CBA just brushed it off and said, well, it's fine, you know, there's a few issues, but we'll just keep peddling, right? And they've been writing a lot of mortgages. Westpac has been writing a smaller proportion of mortgages quite more recently. They've turned it around in the last month or two. But if you look back over my recent reports, you'll see that they were down, you know, the right-hand side in the negative column. So they weren't growing their mortgage book. I think that's significant. And so we're seeing a diversity of strategy between Westpac and CBA. I personally think the regionals are the ones caught in the middle because the big guys can still afford to lend. And they can still access funding really cheaply. Some of the smaller guys probably could access funding via the Reserve Bank. But they do have issues with regard to managing their business and all those things. So I'm quite cautious about the regional banks at the moment. And, you know, I'm not sure whether I don't think it's unlikely they'll go pop, as you say. More likely they'll get a hand from the Reserve Bank or a hand from government in some way. I don't know that they'd just be sort of mopped up like BankWest was and CBA, you know, a decade plus ago, simply because of the concentration of banks in Australia, but we'll see. So, okay, what else we got? Okay, Mount Hawthorne from Yogi Bear, Mount Hawthorne. 6016. Let's put that one in, shall we? 6016. 6016. Apply. There we go. Okay, let me just pop the screen across so you can see it. All right. Mount Hawthorne. 6016. Got that right? Yeah. 4,400 households. 45% in financial stress. That's on a cash flow basis. 1,900 borrowing, 2,000 renting, 1,500 properties for rent, and 958 property owners who've got investment properties somewhere. Mild stress, 640. Severe stress, so when I say severe stress, these are people with more than a 10% deficit between income and expenditure, so that they are the ones very much caught. 41.2, which is quite high, but look at this default rate, 4.2%. And just to recall the Westpac chart from earlier on, that showed, of course, a significant spike in WA. We are seeing defaults rising in WA, and Not only that, but of course, in some places, values have dropped and are continuing to drop at the moment. So that's a problem. Negative equity is a real issue. So 4.2%, 50% of renters in rental stress, and 25% of investors. So there's, you know, reason to think that there's negativity around in that particular postcode. And if I look at the prices, so this is the base case, down 7% over the next 12 months. If you go to 24 months, it's down another 7% to 14.6. And if you go down over three years, the modelling is saying down 20% over the three-year period. So more potential falls. Now, that's on average, right? But that's still quite significant. And, of course, if the high scenario is right, then we're talking up 32%. If the low scenario is right, then we're talking 7% over the 3 years. So that gives you the range. And the question, of course, there is partly, can WA continue perfectly well without the borders opening, or will ultimately the lack of migration and the lack of tourism take its toll on the economy? That's an interesting question. I do know that they've done quite a lot of stimulus with regards to the home builder and with regard to the state stimulus, particularly land packages. And there was a massive spike, of course, once those were announced, and a good number of people piled in. In fact, the average price of a land package went up by $55,000, which was the average of the all the payments that you could get. And now what we're seeing is that that's depressing existing property prices in and around those same areas, because people would prefer to buy new because of the government stimulus. My own view is that's all about stimulating the construction sector. It's very little about helping people to get into the market. And I do worry that people are committing to buy at a particular price, and by the time they get their property in 6-12 months, whenever it is, prices could have fallen further. So that thing's a double risk. So not necessarily one that I'd recommend people do personally, but, you know, people still do it. Cookie Boy says, happy birthday, Cookie Mum, from Cookie Boy. Very good. Thank you for that. Brisbane CBD, postcode 4000, says Ian. And thanks for that, Ian. Let me have a look at Brisbane for you. Clear that. I've been looking at Brisbane quite closely myself because of the fact that I've had several people ask me for detailed analysis of various Brisbane postcodes. So it's been quite interesting. Put this back up again. Okay, so this is Brisbane. 64% of households in financial stress, 8,600 in that particular area, of which 1,600 are borrowing, 6,400 are renting, so very significant renting, 4,900 rental properties available, and number of rental property owners, 3,216. No mortgage stress that I can see. A little bit of default there, 2.3%. But 59% or 3,800 households in rental stress. And that's precisely what I've been seeing. So this is all about a story of rental stress and investor stress. So 68% of property investors in the area are struggling. So this is the Achilles heel of the centre of town. It also cross-correlates quite well to all of the construction of the high-rise and all of the many partly finished buildings that are going up in and around the centre of Brisbane as well. And in my detailed analysis, I teased out units versus houses because there's some fundamental difference. There aren't that many houses in the centre of town. There are a few, but a lot of apartments, of course, and lots of units. And a lot of the pressure is on units. And we're seeing high supply. We're seeing rental drop. We're seeing more come on stream, and we're seeing a whole bunch of negative indicators. So I'm quite negative about prices in Brisbane CBD. Now, if I look at the pricing signals, I'm saying the base case is down 7.3 over 12 months, down 14.2 over 24 months, and down 19.2 over 36 months. So enough to know that there's an issue. Of course, if things go really badly, and then we're talking 32% down over 3 years, which is pretty disastrous. Incidentally, I should say that generally in my modelling, what I find is that unit prices tend to slide faster and further relative to house prices. Houses on a block tend to hold their value slightly more. So when I do my more detailed analysis, I tend to tease those two out and look at the differences. I haven't done this in this current piece of modelling here just because the modelling gets too complicated to do it on the fly. Sean M says, thanks for everything you do, Martin. 3160. Appreciate that. I'm happy to do that. 3160. Okay. Let's do that there. Okay, so we're talking Belgrave and Tacoma. No, I haven't heard of Tacoma before. I wonder where that is. I must look that up later, see where it is. Okay, so we have 3,461 households, of which 74% are in financial stress. It's very high. 2,300 are borrowing. 755 are renting. There are 574 properties for rent. And there are 1,686 owners of rental property. Mild stress, 1,900, which is 82.6%. So this is all about mortgage stress. Defaults, 2.3% or 53 over the next 12 months. It's also a story of rental stress, so 50.1%, 378, but 50.1 is the percentage, and some investor stress. But really, this is a mortgage stress story. So there are many people will have bought in. Perhaps they'll have bought in at quite high prices when their incomes are relatively stable, and now they're finding their incomes are much less stable than previously. So that's the sort of the first part of the story. In terms of price movements, the base case is down 18%, so that's significant over the next 12 months. That's one of the deepest falls I've seen, down to 23% over 2 years and down 26.2% over 3 years. Now, that, of course, is predicated on all the assumptions I made earlier on about the COVID continuing to rage and the fact that the borders aren't open, migration continues to be a problem. And there is some government stimulus, but it's not necessarily as generous as perhaps some would like to see. So that's sort of the base scenario. So looks to me as though that could be a rather troublesome postcode, and I wouldn't be surprised to see significant price slides there later. Okay. What else have we got? Okay. If Martin did the bank's accounts, the impairment charge would be so high the bank would close, says Tom. Maybe. Or maybe I'm just being hyper-realistic about what's going on. Remember, this is stress, right? I just want to highlight the point that stress is not the same as defaults, right? Default rates are much lower. And not every default ends up ultimately being written off, right? There's a fundamental set of processes that you go through. You try and manage the particular situation. So many people are now in the bank's, hospital ward, as it were, being helped to try and manage their situation, maybe looking to restructure their finance, maybe looking to, find a way to sell the property to be able to repay the mortgage. So don't think of stress and default is precisely the same. But stress is an early indicator, right? It's an indicator of what happens 2 or 3 years later. So the reason this is important is because there's a lag, and typically the lag's 3 to 4 years between when things go wrong and when the property price sort of disaster sort of hits the max. If you look at the US, if you look at the UK, it was several years after the global financial crisis that the property drop reached its peak and all the defaults reached their peak. That's because people try to continue to pay their mortgages. They continue to cut back and, try and manage things as best they can. But as Ross McEwan said, and I'll say it again, sometimes it pays to sell early if you've got a real issue, because the longer you leave it, the more it is difficult to unwind. And unless there's an intention of a V and a recovery, and I think almost nobody is now suggesting we're going to be in a V-shaped recovery, not the Reserve Bank, not even CBA. CBA said it's going to be U-shaped, and most people are saying it's going to be 18 months to 2 years with the following wind if we get some relief from the virus one way or the other. So that's why I don't think necessarily that the stress should be directly correlated to write-offs and provisions, those sorts of things, right? And of course, the banks have been putting more provisions in place. The question is, are they providing enough? We won't know until later, of course, but Westpac is definitely putting a bit more against it relative to CBA at the moment. And NAB didn't do a lot more this time around. So my own view is that the banks are still coming to terms with just how big the risk pool is. And maybe we'll get away with it. Maybe people who are in stress will get out of stress again. You know, if they get better incomes, if they find another job. But the trouble I've got is that I think unemployment will be above 10% at the end of this year, and it will be 7% in 2 years' time. So it will down a little bit, but not a lot. And remember, we had unemployment at just over 5% before this all started. And also remember that there's going to be very little wage rise. The other thing that people, of course, got away with in the 2000s was very significant wage rises. So they got big mortgages, but the wage rises supported those mortgages and people could continue to pay them. Not seeing that now. We're seeing, if anything, mortgages being very big, but incomes flat, maybe even falling in real terms. So, and then you've got structural unemployment. What I mean by that is it's not just gig economy workers and part-time workers. It's now corporates laying off middle managers. And in fact, I did an interview today for the ABC, which I think they aired this evening, where I spoke specifically in my surveys about these middle managers who are on big incomes, but suddenly their jobs are being crushed out of existence. And we're going to see, I think, more of that. And those are some of the people who will find it quite difficult to get another job or get a job at the same level to be able to continue their lifestyle the same way. And they are the sorts of people who can end up quite quickly in difficulty. So, yeah, I don't think I'm being overly negative. I'm just telling you the data and the modelling. And, you know, that's what I do, modelling. Okay. What else have we got? There has been a massive recruitment drive for telephone staff at Westpac. So that's interesting. Didn't know that. What I do know is that some branch operators are actually now being involved in debt recovery in some banks, and they've actually started to close some branches early so that they can get into debt recovery mode in the afternoons. Got that from two different sources quite recently. So that's another thing that we're seeing. Okay. This is very interesting. All of this discussion about the COVID hoax and the Great Reset, conspiracy, or, you know, is it just happenstance? I don't know. Haven't got enough evidence to be able to actually hand on heart say I can see a conspiracy. But some will say there is, some will say there could be, some will say I don't know. I don't know. Otto says, seems to me the ANZ confidence meter was trending higher the whole time the Titanic stern was lifting higher out of the water after hitting the iceberg. I love the analogy. Did you ever see my interview with Steve King? It was about 2 years ago now. He and I were talking. We came across this wonderful analogy of the iceberg. Yeah, and you know, you could see this thing ahead, right? You knew that it was going to be a huge obstacle. We're talking about the high debt. And yet nobody really wanted to do anything about it. We just sort of kept going towards it, right? And I ended up calling the show, I wonder whether the icebergs will be fluffy, right? Because, you know, hopefully we'll just bump into it and go off. That's a bit scenario, I think. We've got the situation now where all of these are leading indicators. It's not just me, you know. Shane Oliver's now talking about more significant price drops. We've got various other commentators also saying the same. So most people are thinking there will be some falls in property prices. The question is now for how long and how deep. That's why I do scenarios, so I can sort of give you a range of what I see. Cookie Boy makes the point, of course, and it's a very important one. Don't forget to add stamp duty and agents' commissions fees. And that is a point, of course, that when you transact, there are carry costs, and that can actually knock out a significant proportion of any profit you might make, or, you know, if you're thinking of selling now compared with in the future. Those carry costs are very important. Now, there was some debate from the Reserve Bank about maybe stamp duty should be abolished. The question is, if stamp duty is abolished, how will the states pay for some of the things that they currently fund through stamp duty? Big question. Nobody's been prepared to answer that question, so I'm a bit sceptical of this whole thing at the moment. I think it's going to ground on for a lot longer. Okay, what else have we got? Tom says, do I do a survey on stocks too? No, I don't. I don't really do the same sort of analysis on stocks. I don't, because the thing about these surveys is it's sort of surveying households, of course. So I'm asking households about their financial profile. I'm asking them about what their attitude is. You know, I'm asking them about whether they'd like to buy or whether they'd like to sell, all those things. And that goes into my models. So it's all data driven. I don't do the same on stocks. And I don't really, I mean, I do look at stocks from time to time, obviously, but I don't do the same detailed analysis. Okay, what else have we got? Diamantra says 3224. Okay, let's put in 3224 first. Clean this. 3224. Leopold in regional Victoria. Okay, so 5,800 households, 29% stressed, that's quite low, 2,900 borrowing, 1,700 renting, 1,300 properties for rent, 1,500 rental property owners, 856 in stress at 29%, not too bad, 2.9% default, 85, a little high but nothing too serious, 29% rental stress, that's not too bad, and investor stress 20%. So they're not too bad a set of indicators there. But if I look at the pricing, 14.6 down, my base case 12 months, 24-month base case at 19.5, 36 base case at 22% is my best estimation on the data I have. And your point there was bills have gone up in price, established flat. Yeah, I wonder whether that's also to do with the home builder and all those sorts of things. The home and land package situation is really interesting. I was talking to somebody today about this because they were looking at sort of trying to compare and contrast existing property in a postcode with home and land packages. And they were sort of curious as to why home and land packages were so much more expensive relative to existing property. And I made the point that, well, when you buy a home and land package, it's like buying a new car at the garage, right? You drive it out and you immediately lose value. And that's what happens. Plus the fact that with all the home builder incentives, there's been an incentive for developers to lift the price of the land package. So we've seen significant price increases, interestingly. And so those two combinations just create a disparity between existing and new, to the point where I think it's unlikely that many people who've bought into some of the new property will ever see a return. My own view is better to buy the bigger place down the road that might be slightly older on a bigger land block, and you've probably got more chance of enjoying that and seeing more value in the long term. But you know, people make decisions. People like new. I like the smell of new shiny stuff, so I can understand that. Okay, what else have we got? Victoria is not getting out of lockdown for months, says Sally. Well, yeah, it's difficult to know, isn't it? If we assume that the other states won't unlock their borders until there are no cases, which sort of is how they're positioning at the moment, it will be a long slow. Maybe they'll be able to ease back a little bit within Victoria, but the chances of the borders being fully established in the next 6 months or so, I would have thought it's quite low, to say nothing of the international borders, which, of course, will remain a lockdown for much longer than that. And even the idea of the Trans-Tasman bubble is probably now at risk, given the fact that they've got issues in Auckland. This thing is going to go on and on, unfortunately, and that means that some of the economic damage will be quite considerable in the long term. I think a lot of the economic damage has been done. It's interesting, of course, in the UK, they just came out and said, there's going to be a significant bounce back in GDP compared with last quarter. But the fact is that a huge drop and then a bit of a bounce back looks good, but it's still a lot lower than it was. And of course, the forecasting here from the Reserve Bank is that GDP will be lower in 2 years' time than it was before we started this. So the economic consequences of all this going on and the continued lockdowns, I think, is very significant. Ah, interesting question. Somebody asked, what software am I using to make those plots? Where let me find that one again if I can. Hang on. There you go. I can't find the... I just read it. So the particular plots that I'm using when I use the graphs is actually just Excel. I use some MS SQL for the core database, and then I've got Tableau, which is Tableau is this thing, which is giving me all the immediate queries. But the charting in Tableau is very weak. I don't find it particularly powerful when it comes to actually creating charts. So I tend to then put it back into Excel because I can manipulate that. It's not great, but it works all right, and I like the sort of the style of the Excel, so that's the way I do it. All right, let me just go down to see what's here. Okay, Tamantra Beats says, COVID, is it worth the economic damage or is it a conspiracy? Well, there's no doubt that the impact of COVID on individuals can be profound. I lost two close friends, one in the US and one in the UK, both in their 50s, from COVID. Neither of them had pre-existing conditions. Both, one was in the health service, one was not in the health service. Both died within a few weeks of being infected. So anybody who says it's all a myth and, you know, this is just flu, believe me, it's not. For some people, it's really serious. Now, the question is, how many of those relative to the rest of the population, of course, there's different ways of looking at those statistics. But it is serious. I don't think it's, so I've never believed it's been a conspiracy. I've always believed that it's been a real thing. The question is, was the reaction appropriate to close everything down? Or should we have been more cautious and careful in terms of trying to control what was going on? Or should we have actually kept the controls in place for a little longer and strive for more elimination like New Zealand? Now, of course, New Zealand's elimination seems to have come unstuck too. So this is really tricky. But no, I don't think it's just a hoax. I think it's actually, there's real stuff here. You know, I lost people. So maybe I'm biased, but that's my own view. Okay. What else have we got? 4573, says Patrick. Sure. Let's do that, shall we? Okay, 4573, apply. Okay, go to the main. Okay, whoops, push the right button, it'll help. There you go. All right, 12,242 households in, this is Coolum Beach, etc. 33.5% in stress. That's quite a lot lower than some of the others. 4,200 borrowing. 6,000 renting. 4,600 for rent. Number of rental property owners, 3,826. Mild mortgage stress, 743. Severe stress, 351. Percentage in mortgage stress, 25.6. 119 risking default at 2.8. And 1,421 at 23.2% for stressed investors, and sorry, that rental stress, that is 23.3%, and 1,584 stressed investors, it's 42.2%. So of those, it's the investors who are living in the area that probably have the most significant issue for me. Rental stress is not particularly high, and mortgage stress at 25% is not as high as you've seen it elsewhere. In terms of the price movements, so the base case is down 5%, then down 12.2%, then down 17.9% over the next 3 years. So that's down 17.9 over 3 years. That's the base case. So not as severe as some, but still enough to notice that there's an issue. So I hope that's been of some help. I'm going to push this button. I keep forgetting this. I do actually have this alternative view. So this is actually the old studio setup that I've got here, just to show you that, you know, there is a little bit of tech behind the scenes to make this all work. I've got my control panels over here, and I've got the screens here and chats here and things. So that's the way that I set the studio up, just so that you can see that there's a little bit that goes on behind the scenes that I don't normally show. But there you go. That's just a little bit of a glimpse there. All right. Now, Sunshine Girl says, I think Martin's right about having to go granular. Oz is many different markets. The Fed will inflate, probably a hard asset. Yeah, well, let's just take it apart. So firstly, granularity is critical, right? These high-level indices, forget it. They don't tell you anything useful. They're spruiked. They're being spruiked by the media. They're being spruiked by the real estate sector. You have to go granular. So that's the first point. And when I say go granular, you have to go down to a postcode level or a sub-region within postcode, actually, if you can do that. And then you've got to look at units and houses separately, because the dynamics of units and houses are not the same. And one of the things I get frustrated about are these averages that sort of people quote at left, right, and center, right? So you have to look quite granularly. Now, in terms of will the Fed inflate, I'm not sure. Now, you know, I've said several times, and this is a big debate point, right? John Adams and I probably just agree on this, by the way. There is an argument to say that all of the money printing that is really real money printing, it's basically just moving money around in the system, is going into the financial markets rather than the real markets, rather than the Main Street. So it inflates some financial assets. It bails corporates out. But it doesn't necessarily have to be inflationary. If that is true, then we could see the economy in the US go the same way as Japan, which is very low inflation. Now, I know there are differences in terms of debt and all those other things. But so there's an inflationary route, a deflationary route. I'm not convinced yet that I can see which way it's going to go, which is why I sort of sit on the fence a bit with inflation or deflation. You know, some people, like Harry Dent, talk about deflation and therefore significant market falls. There are other people who think it's going to be inflationary and therefore some assets are going to actually definitely benefit from that. Who knows? What I can also say is that property is an asset and it's a hard asset. But the question is what it's worth. A property is worth what somebody will pay for it. Okay? Property has no value at all until somebody buys it. That's actually the real truth. So whilst you can talk theoretically about the value of property going up, value going down, you don't know until you put your property in the market and see what the appetite is. I've been through four downturn cycles in property in various places around the world. And, you know, the worst was I lost about 25% of value of my property at that time. So I've been through those cycles. I know properties can go down. And whilst you can say, yeah, it is a hard asset, it has some value, you don't know precisely what that value is, what the fair value is. Remember, in Australia, fair value of property is 40% under what it currently is sitting at the moment on average. So if you want to sort of build it up and say, what is property truly worth today? It's about 40% less and what most people are seeing as their fair value at the moment, right? That means that there's always plenty of movement around. And if you look at the US, Europe, UK, Ireland, there we have prices fall down 40% at peak in some areas. It goes back to granularity again. So you need to be cautious, I think, about thinking that somehow property is this magic asset class that always goes up, that always retains value, that is always a hard asset. Sure, it's land, and land has some intrinsic value, presumably, always. But land plus the property plus this sort of fluffy value on top, which is basically being created, as I said earlier on, by money printing and by low interest rates and by all the incentive schemes, that is fluff. And that fluff can get blown away, which is why I say that fundamentally, property in Australia is valued 40% above where it should be. That's the truth, I think. Ray says, why not try MS Power BI? If I had nothing else to do, I'd probably teach myself another new set of tools, but I'm a little bit under the pump, so I just get by with what I got, frankly, generally. Although I do have some help to build this this app. So the version of what you're seeing today, which I've got in Tableau, we're going to be able to put online and make it a bit more flash and those things, so people can get some data directly out of the system rather than having to ask me to do it all the time, which will be good. So I can hopefully share some more data for more people so that we can actually get on and focus on things. Okay, what else we got? A property is worth what someone will pay for it, and the dollars they borrow to pay for it don't exist until they are borrowed. Well done. That's ADV Dad correct. That's exactly right. And remember again, you know, banks create money when they actually want to give a loan. It's an electronic transaction. That's how money happens. That's why it's not limited to the amount of deposits and other things. It's actually created. And then it comes into existence. Fiat let it be. That's what fiat means. And from there, you can basically, the money goes into the system. And that's still a very unpopular view, by the way, of how money works. Many other people would say, no. It starts with deposits. So deposits is where, and then the banks lend it out and fractional reserve. No. That's, unfortunately, that's not the way it actually works in practice. Now, there are still other rules like Basel and things to stay over the top. But the cornerstone is that, sure, banks can create as much credit as there is demand. That is why everybody's talking about the banks lending more, right? That's what the RBA wants. The RBA wants people to borrow more because that's going to build a bigger economy, and that's going to essentially create more momentum, and that will give more capital that people can go spend and create more activity and drive the GDP. That's what it's about. The question is that a sensible strategy, or is there a point at which you've got to say, oh, we can't just go on going round the houses and creating more and more money and inflating assets ever higher. As I showed you earlier on, from the 1980s, property went through the roof. Do we need a different route? My own view is we need to come back to a more fundamental view of how property works within the economy, spend less of our effort and money and time on investing in property and investing more in productive investments for businesses who are crying out for investments in Australia. It amazes me how many people really struggle just to get businesses working at the moment because everybody just wants to invest in property. So to me, it's got to be a rebalance. But that's a very unpopular view. And the fact is that many people will say, no, just keep the Ponzi scheme going a bit further. But it is a Ponzi scheme. You need more new people to borrow, to be able to lift prices, to be able to actually raise the bank's balance sheet, to be able to lend more, to lift house prices. That's the circuit. Cookie Boy says, have I watched the latest Steve Van Meter video? Yeah, I do, and yes, I do. I mean, I think he's right. I should recommend a shout out to Steve. If you want to understand what's really going on with the financial markets and the bond markets, Steve is a very, very good guy. He's been on my show a couple of times. Go across to his channel. He's got some really powerful views to explain that the Fed really isn't printing money. It's just sort of moving money around. And that it's all about what the bonds are going to be doing. And he's actually quite funny as well. He's got a crown. He's called the Bond King. So go and look at Steve. I'll put the link in the comments below later. Andrew says, have I heard of Richard Venner and the Prince of the Indies? I have. Can see why the Big Short guys went for the Big Short in 2008. No one learns ever. No, well, actually, if you want to, you know, revise the Big Short, it is a really profound film. And it is just worth watching the herd instinct that everybody sort of piles in and everybody just believes and continues to believe, right? And it ultimately it becomes one of confidence and it becomes one of trajectory. If all the lemmings go in that direction, then that's the direction that everybody heads in. Doesn't mean it's right. So the Big Short got a big tick from me. Thanks, Cookie Boy. Yeah, Steve was indeed a great catch, and he and I will be doing some more shows. He bet me that we will be talking with him again within a month or so about bonds. I think that's probably right. So thanks for that. And somebody said, Steve's pretty amusing. Can we get him a nicer crown, though? Yeah, a good point there. Okay. Thanks, Plexus. Great. Well done. So Steve's channel is now up in the chat there. Yeah, the US and doing lives in the evening are pretty difficult, Cookie Boy, as you suggested, George Gammon. But George and I will be talking again. We've got plans to make another show quite soon, and we're going to go and delve into some of this in a bit more detail. Dylan says, can you speak to the number of surveys a week? Okay, so the way it works, this is the way that DFA does its surveys. I use a big research firm to make the phone calls. It's a phone-based survey. It's an omnibus. And they have an obligation to give me back 1,000 answers to my questionnaire every week, 1,000 a week, statistically optimized to the ABS census. All right. So it's a 0.5% sample overall because I have 52,000 in my sample at any one time. And it is checked against age, demographics, geography to make sure that it is in line with the census. So that's how we keep it in line. So we don't make any statistical adjustments to the data. The raw data coming in is like a mini census every week. That's how it works. And it's been pretty resilient over the last 20 years or so. I started in 2002, so it's nearly 20 years since I've been doing these surveys. And we started with half the sample size, so 500 a week. And then a few years ago, went up to 1,000 a week to give us the 0.5% sample. So that's the way it works. And we cover the whole of Australia, and we can match it back to the census distribution by age, by geography, by demographics. And that gives us a reasonable length, sort of degree of confidence. The other way we can do it is we can total up the total, what the total model says in terms of mortgages, what's the total mortgage outstanding. If you then gross it up based on the 0.5% sample, it's within 2% of the total RBA figures for mortgages in Australia. So we know that the lending figures work as well. Okay, well, we are now close to the end of the show. What I'm going to do is just let me just go back to my presentation. There's a few things I just want to cover off at the end here. Let me do that. Okay. So if you want to see more about what we do, go to the DFA blog. You can sign up there to get alerts. You can also send me a message direct on the DFA blog. There's a little chat app down on the blog. Quite a few people do that. If you want to support our work, you can do that via Patreon. There's various tiers. From $3 US plus GST up to an exorbitant $500 a month for all the data. Some people actually take all the data. But the one that's really quite popular is this $50 a month plus GST to get all of the stress data, like I showed you tonight, for every postcode in Australia every month. And that's available about a 1 week after the month end. So that's available as a way of essentially engaging with me if you want more information. The other way is this DFA one-on-one. I launched this a couple of weeks ago, and essentially it's an individual discussion with me about a particular postcode. I don't give specific financial advice, but I can talk about a postcode and pull out some of the critical issues like, you know, rental profiles and property values and all the things we've been talking about, plus a few others, look at some underlying trends and make some predictions about where I think prices may go over the next 3 years. And so that means I can look at stress, home price trend, and all the modelling. Now, you can book for that. It's normally a Zoom or a phone conversation, up to an hour. Varies a little bit, but no more than an hour. And the point about that is that I've decided to charge for that $100 Aussie dollars plus GST. That's not the cost of doing it, but it's just to help make sure that people are serious if they want a conversation. I'm not doing this to make money. I'm just doing this because I think it's a really important service. And a lot of people I've spoken with have said they really value the conversation. And so if you're interested, you can contact me via my blog. I mentioned that above. Spaces are limited each week, and the bookings now are about 3 weeks ahead because I've got so many people sharing an interest in it. But pretty much everybody who's had the chance to speak with me one-on-one, so that they found it a really powerful experience. So, you know, the offer's there. Send me a message, and if you want to follow it up, then we can explore it. You can also make a contribution via PayPal if you'd like to support my work just directly, as some people do. Thank you for that. It really helps. Again, we don't make a massive amount out of all of this. This is just to cover the costs of all everything we do. Or Bitcoin, even if you want to go down that route. Or even merch. And I've explained the merch a few times. It's there if anybody's interested. Had a few people pick a few mugs and what have you. So if you want a DFA mug, that's available. In terms of top hits, I do the DFA daily quite often. Through a glass darkly got a good resonance with a lot of people. I'm talking with Tarot Brooker again the next few days. His last show is going extremely well, so worth looking at that. I also cover Bitcoin sometimes. I had a conversation with Stefan Levera, which was quite interesting. I've got a show with Caroline Bowler from BTC Markets to put up, which I recorded the other day, and a few more to come. So we'll continue to cover some of the Bitcoin stuff too. Joe Wilkes is around, and in fact, late breaking news in a second, but Joe Wilkes and I will be doing a live Trans-Tasman property discussion next week. So Joe Wilkes will be on DFA Live this time next week, and we'll be able to compare and contrast Australian and New Zealand property and explore some of the additions. So spread the word to New Zealand, and any Kiwis watching this, make sure you come on next week and support Joe. It'll be a very interesting session. So that's the next week's Q&A. And there's also this other show, which John Adams and I, we reposted this, Solving the Gold Leasing Riddle, which is what's happened to our 11 tons of gold. We basically set the question up. It's a program we made a couple of years ago, which we've reposted. But in a week or so, maybe less now, we'll do a part two and give some answers to that. So that's just something else we're doing. As I say, Joe Wilkes is on next week. The following week, I'll be doing the update to the scenarios and all the new stress stuff. The week after that, Tony LeCantre will be back on again, and we'll have a chat with him. And then a couple of weeks after that, I've got Chris Bates, the mortgage broker, coming on to have a live chat about property then. So that's sort of the guests that I know about. There are some other ones probably coming as well. So a few other things going on. Okay, so there we are, 9:31. We've once again hit the buffers. I hope that you've enjoyed the shows over the last couple of weeks. I've been focusing in on property because I felt that we really needed to go deeply into property and to try and expose some of the myths that are out there about what's going on with property. So we'll continue to do that. We're going to get more and more granular. We're going to actually tell the story more and more and more. And what I hope to do is to use some of the one-on-one conversations to be able to enrich some of the things that I do more broadly without, of course, in any way referring it into specific confidential conversations. Everything I say one-on-one is completely confidential. But some of the trends that are coming out are really interesting, so I hope to do a show on that a little bit later. Okay, so I want to say thank you very much for spending some time with me this evening. We hit a reasonable number, not quite as high as the other day. So clearly, we need another Edwin to get up to 1600. But nevertheless, I'm satisfied with that. Thank you very much for sharing this evening with me. I hope you found it useful. Please do share and like the post. And if there are specific questions or issues you'd like me to consider in future shows, drop me a message. You can do that via the DFA blog. Always interested in people's questions and in people's observations. I do try to take them all on board. I don't necessarily comment on everything that people send me these days because there's just so much. My email box is stuffed full all the time. But nevertheless, I do think that what we do here is really important, particularly now, particularly with the uncertainty that we face. And I just leave you with this thought that the decisions you take around property can affect your life, not just for months, but for years. And there are still people there making snap decisions on property and being sucked into FOMO even now, even at this time. And so my counsel to everybody is be really careful, really cautious, do the research, delve more deeply, really understand what's going on, get the information, and only then make the decision, whatever that decision is, because you can often live to regret at leisure decisions taken in haste. And with property, that is so, so true. So with that warning, thank you very much for watching. Stay safe. And I'll look forward to seeing you this time next week when Joe Wilkes will be on and we'll be talking Trans-Tasman property. I look forward to seeing you there. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off.